So good morning, everyone. And before again beginning to speak, I would like to encourage everyone to generate the right intention, bodhicitta. Most of you who have been practicing are familiar with how to correct one's intention by founding all generation of thoughts to be combined, to be unified with the best of the aspiration. And the most sincere aspiration that you can generate is to wish the happiness and the encountering with the causes of happiness for all sentient beings. May through the power of aspiration, through the blessings of all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, may through the power of strength of one's any merit that one may have accumulated through the three times, arise favorable circumstances, and the most favorable circumstance that anyone can enter is to find wisdom within one's own self. And so may all sentient beings have such an opportunity. May each one find a way of bringing about cessation of suffering. May particularly all efforts engaged and generated in the path of practice by this meditator not be distorted again and again by the eight worldly dharmas, but may it be for the single purpose of finding cessation from cyclic existence for self and the others. And therefore, in that way, in one's own mind, recollecting and bringing an awareness of the qualities of the Buddha, generating sincere sense of refuge into the Buddha, likewise reflecting upon the supreme qualities and the pureness of the Dhamma, and into that perfect Dhamma, the truth as it is, taking refuge, likewise recollecting the qualities of the Sangha, and into this Sangha, that is, as the Bodhisattvas have called the field of merit, being able to take sincere refuge. Into the Sangha of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, I take refuge. May through the essence of refuge, my mind not waver from the determination to realizing the inherent, basic, fundamental nature. So we are continuing to speak about the topic that KTD has given me to talk on, disturbing emotions, and what do we do with them. So yesterday we spoke a little bit about the importance of recognizing the root cause from where what we call disturbing emotions to be. As in the case of any situation where, such as if we are inflicted with some kind of a disease, for that individual person to recover, to get well from a disease, from an infliction, for the patient as well as for the physician to be able to be free from the disease, to find an antidote, a remedy to recover from the disease, to benefit the others, requires one to first find the actual cause from where the ailment comes, so that whatever is administered can be appropriate, can be suitable, can be truly helpful. And so in the same way, for us to be able to aspire to be free from those disturbing emotions that we see as destructive to self, causing self-destruction, as well as bringing about and inflicting destruction on the others, from the perspective of a practitioner's path of practice of the Buddha Dhamma, knowing the root cause is very important. So yesterday we used the example of tattered clothing upon which beautiful patches are the tendencies that we have. But where those patches may be beautiful, nevertheless are not able to really do much in terms of covering your body if the base upon which it is attached continues to remain the same old tattered clothing. In the same way, where the fundamental mind of the meditator refuses to budge, move, become a little bit more flexible, additions of any remedy upon such a mind has very little benefit. And so that is what we suffer from. If we look at it from a cursory observation, we will find that most of us exert tremendous effort in trying to cultivate good qualities. We do exert a lot of qualities of kindness, compassion, devotion, diligence. We take our physical body to meditation. We take our speech to meditation. And the mind, the ordinary mind, does try to understand the teachings, to remember the teachings as often as possible. Nevertheless, the genuine transformation that should come through having exerted so much effort on the path of practice doesn't really live up to the correct ratio or the proportions in terms of what is the input. So we always say, yes, I'm practicing Dhamma for a long time. I have lots of devotion. And if someone were to ask me, do you actually have devotion to Dhamma? Yes, of course, it's unquestionable that I have devotion to the Dhamma. But still, why is there so little change happening? Why is that the resultant state? And of course, as all good Buddhists, many of us try to not have any clinging to fruition. Now, it's a very polite thing to say for most Buddhists. I don't mind whether the actual fruition is happening or not, but that we are not supposed to have any clinging. Nevertheless, I don't know whether you think about it, but I think about it. So why is not so much happening? Because in the engagement of ordinary activities, the input and what you get from that input, if not more than what you are inputting, at least something should come out of it. But with regard to the Dharma, if it seems to retain the same, then you always ask the question, which I often used to when I grew up, is why is it that, because you used to read in the older times, whether it is the students of Shakyamuni Buddha himself, whether it is all the Nalanda, great Nalanda pandits, whether the 25 disciples of Padmasambhava, and then also you see the great lineage masters all around in our rooms over here at the shrine room, all of the great lineage master themselves and their students. Each one of them seem to have obtained fruition in the lifetime that they practiced the Dharma. I grew up in a family where from our childhood we were told, oh, so and so of your ancestor obtained this realization at the age of 10, age of 15, age of 13. And so I used to grow up and think, at least if nothing, the genes should have rubbed something. You know, they say there's a lot of power in that. And so in our case, nothing seems to happen. It's so stubborn. And so excellent teachers, the same enlightened masters, the same teachings, the same method. And it is not that you're not practicing. You're spending hours and hours actually trying to understand the teachings. But then what's the output? What is it that we are generating? What is it that we actually gain from them is very feeble, some kind of, let's say, recognition or mindfulness. Vaguely from behind the mind that says, don't do it, don't do it. Or let go, or something like that. But the force of the habits are so strong that even before you have a chance to recognize what the message is, you've been drowned into the habitual patterns. And then you think, what happened? So it's definitely something wrong. In some cases, we blame external situations. In many cases, and if you are a good practitioner, you blame yourself. And then you fall into the pattern of saying, oh, I really must be someone with tremendous negative karma, or that I'm just stupid, or that my ignorance is so strong, my emotions are so very strong. And then you come up with the perfect excuse that we Tibetans have discovered through the hundreds of years of working with one's own habitual pattern, is we've placed our hope into next life. So that next time, earlier start, better teachers, without all these family members sort of and their responsibilities being on my shoulder. Next life, right from the baby stages, then meeting with Dharma and then having a better opportunity to practice the Dharma, we begin to place our hope into something else. Now, this is just the example of the tattered clothing with the patches. And so that is what happens. Now, the blame cannot be placed, the inability to bring about the required results of the Dharma. Dharma is powerful. The teachings are excellent. It is as it has been during the time of Shakyamuni Buddha. Difference is in the clarity of one's own mind, which arises in the form of honesty. To be honest in your approach to the practices, so that everything is not being relegated to the sphere of intellectual theory. But having the courage and the honest approach to embody the teachings so that one is able to see the Dharma and the approach to the Dharma as founded on the foundation of letting go of that tattered clothing, your own nature, personality, habits, what you think is your identity, that characteristic that we identify our own individual self with. And somewhat yesterday we talked about how much it tries to capture desire and crave for the self so that it can assert to the others the identity of the self-cherishing attitude. So that tendency, which is then here seen as the tattered clothing, no matter how fond you are of it, no matter how sort of familiar the patterns are, and that familiarity sustains a sense of comfortableness, even if you do not like it. But the courage and the honest approach must be there in knowing that that old clothing, that old habitual pattern, that old impulse, that familiar impulse must be let go of, and to, in its place, replace it with genuine awareness, with genuine sense of wisdom that is able to discern between causes that are helpful for oneself and causes that are negative, cause of harm, which must be eliminated from one's own mind stream. So transforming discursive or disturbing emotions taught primarily by the Buddha himself in the profound path of the Hinayana teachings is perhaps one of the most pithy and direct teachings that have to be engaged in. Now, when we approach teachings, we talk about Hinayana teachings, we talk about Mahayana teachings, and then we talk about the unsurpassable secret Mahayana teachings, which today most people refer to as Vajrayana teachings. But Vajrayana, as again many of you know, is not a vehicle. Vajrayana is an extension of Mahayana, and in many of the Mantrayana teachings referred to simply as absolute Mahayana teachings or simply secret Mahayana teachings. Now, this term secret has, I think, sort of many situations where it is not understood correctly. So there's nothing secret here as in concealment or being kept away from the people, but secret simply because it is so directly in front of yourself, and yet one's delusion does not allow us to see it clearly, so it's self-hidden. It is not so apparent to us, and therefore that what is there and yet is veiled by our own ignorance and having to recognize that very intrinsic absolute truth is what the main sort of objective of the Vajrayana teachings, what we call Vajrayana teachings. However, Vajrayana or the Mahayana teachings and the Hinayana teachings, each one of them in the Dhamma or the practice of our Buddhist tradition, have their own ways of looking at what emotions are, what the nature reality of emotions are, and how to either abandon negative emotions according to the Hinayana tradition, transform them into a much more positive attitude, the Mahayana tradition, and look at its true fundamental nature and recognizing its very absolute nature of emptiness, being the then secret Mahayana or the Vajrayana methods that allow us to gain confidence in such a view. So these approaches are all there. Many of us are familiar. Now, within the Vajrayana, Mantrayana, or the profound path of the teachings of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, transcendence of disturbing emotions are one of the greatest and the profound teachings. So, however, to transcend is possible, but at the same time, if we approach practice from a very honest approach, from where we are, and an honest approach means knowing yourself very well, that is honesty. Honesty requires being able to have a sense of truthfulness, neither exaggerating your potential nor denigrating your capacities, but very objectively being able to know yourself very well. And in knowing our own selves very well, sometimes we see transcendence is very possible, yet it may be a little difficult at this moment. And therefore, one must also look at perhaps the benefits of transformation and the path of the teachings and the guidance of the Bodhisattva path given to us by the exceptional kindness of great Bodhisattvas, the Buddha himself, and then following him, the great Bodhisattvas, path of transformation, where neurotic thoughts, disturbing thoughts, as soon as they pop up, can be subjugated by a strengthened positive attitude, a strengthened attitude of the reverse or the exact opposite of negative discursive emotions. Such that, almost in the sense where the Bodhisattva path says, if you must generate thoughts because one is not able to see that these are merely projections of one's own mind, if you must do them, then why not use that energy of activeness to a positive, in a positive direction? If you must think, think well. If you must generate thought, think positive thoughts. If you must speak something, say something good. If you must be busy with activities of the body, make sure that it is something that is good, causing more happiness, bringing more happiness, creating more causes of happiness, conducive factors, rather than being overwhelmed and subjugated or powered by the negative tendencies, negative emotions, and then unawareness sort of becoming so powerful that one is creating a lot of causes and conditions that will eventually bring about the generation of fruition of suffering and pain for oneself and others. So transformation is also taught in the Buddhist tradition of Mahayana. Then again, the honest approach is to see whether or not you are capable of doing that. Now, if a simple question were asked, can you do it? Yes, we can do it. Can you do it all the time? Then I don't know. Why we can't do it all the time is because maybe from an honest analysis of one's own capacity, aspiration may be more powerful than actuality. As long as the actual ability to be mindful, to be able to remain more with a non-distracted awareness, a seamless continuum of non-distractedness, is not strong enough, merely by having the aspiration of working with transformation might be, again, becoming very optimistic. Therefore, again, through one's own sort of reflection, through knowing one's own nature, one's own personality, you have to, as a practitioner, recognize Dhamma is applied to you. Dhamma is applied to me. To be able to apply the Dhamma, the antidote, to me, I must know myself well. Knowing myself well without denigrating the self. That's a very bad habit, which meditators do. You look a little bit at yourself and then you decide, oh, it's a very afflicted, neurotic, bad mind with lots of karma, habitual patterns. And sometimes we are almost proud and happy to have found how bad we are. That doesn't serve any purpose. That is, again, another trick of the ego that says, you know, you're a Buddhist. You're supposed to have two qualities, humility and non-grasping. So don't grasp to this awareness. Be humble at the wrong moment. I will survive very well if you do that. And so without our recognizing at that moment, and I always say, you know, you're never humble your whole life. The moment you need to be a little bit more proud of your capacity, then the sort of mistimed humility sets in. That's not necessary. Humility is important, but here maybe being a little bit more confident would be of greater use. So denigrating of self is one of the obstacles that meditators often come up. Sometimes people become proud of that deprecation of one's own potential, disrespect of one's own potential. Sometimes we become sort of frivolous towards this self-criticism. And so we almost joke about how weak we are, how ignorant we are. And so you walk up to your teachers and how happily do you declare, oh, I am your ignorant student. And that's, you know, sounds nice, it's entertaining for some moment. We feel maybe the teacher also sometimes pets your cheek and says, yes, yes, you have a good sort of understanding of yourself. And sometimes we approach and we think, I've really expressed myself to my teacher with most humility. And now sort of I've done my daily rota of humbleness and being truthful with my own self. Now, beyond what is being expressed, if there is, again, what sets in, this kind of a false, sometimes, a false or a conceptual, fabricated humility, brings in complacency. Not only is there disrespect for one's own capacity and potential, but you become complacent with that inability to go beyond your habitual patterns and the karmic impulses. So where that happens, then there is stagnation. Where there is complacency, there is no penetrating insight and wisdom that goes from it. There is a dullness and a complacency in the dullness of the mind. And so then eventually, then we only subsist our path of practice on hope. We hope something will happen. We hope some accidental enlightenment will take place. We hope some other more powerful practice or more powerful situations will happen. And then, of course, since the dependency on an external condition to bringing about enlightenment becomes more and more strong, then, number one, there is an addiction to that kind of an hope. And number two, it retains your own negative habits, and change and transformation doesn't come. Therefore, for that tendency that is seen in the meditators, the deceptive message that the ego-grasping mind will play out and try to dominate your awareness, great masters of the Vajrayana tradition starts the preliminary practices with reflection on preciousness of human existence. The four reminders, or what are called the four thoughts that transform the mind, if you really look at it, starts always with not impermanence. It doesn't start with bodhicitta. It doesn't start with transformation or transcendence. It doesn't start with Buddha nature. Vajrayana path starts with preciousness of human existence. It counts 18 qualities that constitute the endowments and the freedoms that you enjoy. Freedoms that you have, which gives you a sense and an awareness of the enormous freedom that you have to exercise your own choice. There is, in counting all the freedoms, without going into the literal sort of enumeration of them, but the summation of the 8 freedoms simply comes down into there is nothing that stands between you and enlightenment other than your own inability to approach it without hesitation. So there's only your hesitation that stands there. And what is that hesitation? Hesitation is, I would like enlightenment without changing. I want to go in as myself. With all what I like, what I don't dislike, yes, we'll abandon that. But what I like, what I think is my identity, what I think or who I think I am, I am going to go in as that. So that later on in history, I think we say something like this, maybe not in so many words, but we think, later on in history, somebody should know at least that that enlightened person was Khandro Rinpoche. Otherwise, what's the fun of getting enlightened if nobody would know? If you couldn't do something. So sometimes we think at least a huge gong should ring that announces to everybody else, I'm not going to ask for much. I don't want to hang as a painting. I don't want to have rays and lights. I don't want clairvoyance. I can let go of all that big things. But my family should know at least. There's that one person in your life whom you really wanted to prove that you were right. So that person should at least know that you're enlightened. So variations of these very strange suppositions are what we carry, all founded in the simple thing is that the self is going to get enlightened. That's what it is. It's the identity that we hold, who we are, and this is going to get enlightened. Then if that is the thought, then what is the difference between samsaric mind, discursive mind, and such a mind? Yes, of course, in the process of trying to pursue that, some goodness are what we carry on. We try to be more generous than others. There is a little bit more patience than what others who have absolutely no idea of even so much may not have. And of course, in that light, yes, there are lots of good merit, good karma that you create, but the path and the progress on the path becomes so prolonged. And that prolonging of the process defies the truth of impermanence. And so you never know what comes first, death or realization. And since the progress on the path is what we have chosen to keep very slow in its speed, impermanence moves at a higher speed. So therefore, you have no choice but to place your aspirations of enlightenment in another lifetime or in another kind of a situation. Now, the result of that is an absolute, wonderful, remarkable ability that you enjoy in this lifetime is not valued. Rather than valuing this moment, what you are capable of doing, the power of exercising your choices, your freedom, is totally ignored. And the same mind places hope on another situation where you might have the same kind of, if you're very lucky, situation such as this. Today, instead of working with transformation of one's own attitude, I will do so when all hundreds of more favorable circumstances come and I reach the same point as I do now. But I will not do it now. I will do it in a now that happens sometimes in the future. And so we waste our time. We waste our life. We fool ourselves. The neurotic tendencies and the habits continuously goes on. And therefore, the Vajrayana teachings really emphasize transforming one's mind. And what does transforming the mind? If you look at four reminders as they are called, what's the purpose of giving you any reminder? Londok Nambaji, as they are called in Tibetan. Four thoughts that transform the mind. Why does it need to have a transformation? What is it transforming from? It needs to transform from this state of ignorance to a state of better clarity that recognizes that there is actually no real reason or a sane reason that's strong enough or valid enough that would actually make you cherish the ignorance more than the discursiveness. So that's the first reminder. Second is the transformation of one's own attitude from abandoning negative attitudes to cultivating positive attitudes. Because this life is precious, because you are capable of doing it, because you have an enormous capacity called the inherent wisdom, that is able to, if given strength and power, illuminate the darkness sustained by this mind's supposition that all negative thoughts are important for its existence. So one begins to see, what are these negative thoughts? What are these negative things that we sustain? And so here then again, when we are working with transforming disturbing emotions, then you have to see, what are the disturbing emotions? Of the 51 mental events that the mind is said to be preoccupied with constantly, 21 afflictions are mentioned within our own selves. So when you say, this human life, which is precious, it needs to transform, it needs to make the right choice, it needs to transform from discursiveness to wisdom, it needs to recognize its precious quality and see all the negativities that need to be abandoned. It needs to exercise its freedom to retain its own basic awareness. In such cases, mind must also know, what are the disturbing emotions? What is it that you are trying to overcome over here? Three root poisons: anger, desire, ignorance. Five root poisons: to these three, you add jealousy and pride or arrogance. Now, from the perspective of the Hinayana teachings, as I was saying, Namayana and Vajrayana, as they talk about, but the Hinayana approach is a very realistic, grounded, practical approach. The Buddha's own teachings were, in some ways, you can say that the highest Mahamudra and the Dzogchen teachings are contained in the Hinayana teachings. Negative emotions, the three root causes, the three root poisons, anger, desire, and ignorance. In the Hinayana teachings, the Buddha simply approaches it very directly by saying, see them as poison, abandon them. There is, I think, absolutely no more, a greater direct truth presented, nor a more profound teaching given than this very straight message. To a person who has, what we say, common sense. You walk on the roof, and then you start walking down the roof towards the edge of the roof. There comes a time when you know one more step and you'll fall off the roof and die. And you do not do that. There's a common sense that says, not one more step. In the same way, I give the classic example that I used to do. Poke your finger in the electric outlet. Your house is full of plug points where you plug in the electricity. How many of you do what I did? Poke your finger to see where does the hole lead to. We don't do that, although your whole house is surrounded by it. Why don't you do it? It's because you know you can get electrocuted and die. Now, we seem to have some amount of common sense in knowing not to do these things. Now, disturbing emotions. What's the difference? When you drink a cup of tea or water, when you go to India, all the Westerners, there's a lot of examination of the water that you drink. Is it clean? Is it safe? Is it good? Is it not good? Now, disturbing emotions, do we concentrate on them as much as we would concentrate on the cleanliness of the water, pureness of the water? Something that is negative to one's own self, how difficult is it for that person to see it as poisonous, harmful, self-destructive and destructive to the others, and abstain from it? So if one were to take the directness of that simple approach, very profound approach, very truthful approach that is taught in the Hinayana teachings, one would not have to then do everything that we are doing. Transformation and transcendence and all the, you know, Buddha Dharma is a complicated path of practice. Great learned ones like the great Longchenpa, for example, at the point where he died, and there is in the history of Tibetan Buddhism, said no one greater or more learned than the great Longchenpa. Even just the number of texts and volumes that he had sort of memorized, it is said to be, I don't know, something like 20 or 30 elephants could not carry the number of volumes that he could memorize, that he had in memory. But at the time of his death, he had said, Sheja Kunchab, the sort of unsurpassable limitlessness of the Dharma is such that what he knows of what is there of the teachings of the Dharma is like a needle tip in comparison to the expanse of the sky. That's how complicated Buddhism is. You start reading texts, it's endless. Each teacher through the history of Buddhism coming out with, you know, each single one of these great masters came out with the genius, wisdom, and mind of no more than a dozen volumes each in their lifetime. Their great students, then each one of them composes dozens of commentaries on the dozens of root texts. And then subsequently, each generation keeps on adding to that. You'll run out of space, no matter how big a shrine or temple you build, were you to archive all the teachings that are there. Now that is just in black and white, written forms. Then the complexities of the human mind makes even the explanation of it more and more intricate. Each subject of the Dhamma can be taken, and then if you begin to actually go into details about the subject itself, a word can actually lead to hundreds of days of explanation, and you would still find much more to analyze, much more to ponder, much more to work with. Now that's contemplation and commenting. Then engaging in the practices. How long, however long you drag the stubbornness of the mind, Dharma is going to also be taken along, and it could be thousands of years journey that your mind would engage in the path of the practices. So in some ways, if you look at Buddhism and what the doctrine itself is, what the philosophy it is one of the most intricate and the complex teachings and practices that are there. The methods are so many thousands that it is said there is a method each for each individual, and for each deceptions that we come, there is an antidote, making it limitless in numbers. However, all of those complexities, if brought down, are simple things, such as you're sitting in meditation, all the forms that you visualize, all the mantras that you recite, all the good behavior that you behave, adopt, all the vows, samayas that you keep, lineages that you follow, retreats that you do, readings that you have, meditations that you meditate upon. None of these, which comprises the whole universe of the Dharma teachings, would actually be necessary were you to get the crucial point. What is poisonous should be abandoned. It's not necessary or good for you or for the others. Be good. That's it. So what is limitless, complex, and so vast as teachings, as Dharma is, however, can be condensed into what the Buddha himself taught in the very direct presentation of the Hinayana teachings. And so in this way too. Beating around the bush about how many different kinds of methods of transforming or being free from disturbing emotions, we will talk about it, since we have to cover, what, 4 or 5 talks? But they will seem a lot like, you know, okay, in my mind I always think, get to the point. But we won't get to the point, because simplicity is what we are most incapable of understanding. Why we are incapable of understanding the very direct and the simple approach is because the deceptions and the hypocrisy of ego mind will not make it very easy. Since the intricacies of the ego-based mind are so very complex, then it also became necessary for the antidote to become just as intricate, just as complex. Of course, none of the teachers, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, had the plan to burden practitioners with the vast number, limitless methods, and the sort of complexities of the different views. But since the resistance and the stubbornness that stems from the ego-based mind itself is so very complex, is so very stubborn, that the antidotes have to then be able to measure up to that and be more powerful. And so that's how we live our lives. And so sometimes I say the irony of even doing such a thing as the very, you know, there are many monks and nuns here who are wonderful practitioners, lay also, who have done many years of retreat. And so I think it's excellent. That's the way to devote your life to the Dhamma. And it is an exceptional practice that you do. But on the other hand, you have to always think in your mind the irony of actually closing yourself up in a box before you begin to have the determination, I'm going to be a good person. I'm not going to have anger. I'm going to let go of stinginess and selfishness. I'm going to stop being jealous. I'm not going to be arrogant. I'm not going to be ignorant. I'm not going to succumb to self-delusion. That simple thought in order to give birth, then there is resistance. If the resistance continues for 1 year, then you go into practice and retreat for 1 year. If the resistance continues for the second year, you continue your retreat for the second year. If it continues for 3 years, you go into the continuity of the retreat for 3 years. Lifelong retreats are also that. As long as the lifelong stubbornness persists, lifelong practice, lifelong retreat has to be generated. So therefore, for the fundamental approach, or the very most important approach and most helpful approach, is to recognize negativities, discursivenesses, afflictions, what we are calling disturbing emotions, to be poisonous in nature, and simply not get into it. Just using the same common sense that doesn't step off an edge of a precipice. Same common sense that is able to examine whether what you are taking into your body is safe or not, in the same way, using the same discerning wisdom. Call it common sense. If you like it to be more sort of loftily expressed, call it discerning wisdom. But it is common sense. A common sense that is able to discern what is unhealthy, what is destructive habit for you as well as for the others, and abstain from that. And so the Hinayana approach is perhaps one of the most powerful and one of the most direct ways of working with eliminating causes and conditions that are harmful for oneself and the others. So as I said, identifying what they are. So if you take the Hinayana approach, identify and see anger and its destructive nature. If one is calling oneself a Buddhist, for example, I always say, if I say, how many of you are Buddhists? And then most of you will raise your hands. By virtue of your having raised your hands when called out to as a Buddhist, itself requires you to be someone who just doesn't indulge in anger. So eliminate anger and you have no disturbing emotion. Eliminate desire, you have no disturbing emotion. Eliminate ignorance, you have no disturbing emotion. If we want it to be a little bit more identified, then we go into what is called 20 afflictions. First, Mahayana teaching says, eliminate troa. I think in English you call it belligerence. A kind of agitation and passive aggressiveness that you hold in your life. What is destructive emotion? Identify it first. It is this habit, impulse, that you carry in your conduct, personality, and your nature. If your characteristic sort of habit that is seen by others, felt by the others, and your own self, that carries subtle aggression, that the physical demeanor of your actions bring out a sense of aggressiveness, rigidity, arrogance, sort of imposing the self over the environment, where everyone has to accommodate what you wish, and that accommodation being more important to you than the well-being of the others. That is the discursive emotion that has to be identified in your own personality. Remember, no matter how devoted you are to your teacher, and as Buddhists you like to carry pictures, I'm always surprised at how many pictures you can take of the same face. Especially when hardly any photograph looks different from the other. You have pictures like, it's all done very well. There are so many of you who take pictures, so that's very nice. But if you take a picture of myself, for example, and sometimes you get that, as you have pictures of your little this way, little that way, little this way, or little that. But it's the same face. Same clothes, same face, no hair. But the one thing that every Dharma boutique or shop sells the most are pictures. And so it's all very nice. I have many pictures of my teachers also. So that's all very nice. But that's not going to help you in the path of liberation. No matter what dimensions the pictures may be, no matter how many texts you might have, how many malas more you get for yourself, bigger or smaller shrines that you may have, that you follow your teacher around the world, or you sit in meditation and do retreats, how many different kinds of samaya practices that you are dedicated to, all of these are okay. They will keep you busy for some time. But ultimately, if there is no letting go of this passive aggressiveness that is evident in your body, in your speech, and in your mind, then there is no change happening. There is no benefit, and it is nothing short of simply fooling yourself. And in that fooling of your own self, creating tremendous deception and fooling, deceiving other sentient beings. Each day that you begin every session with the aspiration to finding freedom from suffering for all sentient beings, there is a promise that you make, there is a commitment that you take. But if that promise, if that commitment is consistently, every day, falling apart because of a belligerent habit, because of a sort of aggressive habit within one's own self, then there is really no benefit. Sadly, that is evident many times. For example, when you begin a session and you begin with prostrations, and sometimes there is aggression immediately in that prostration, how you prostrate. Whether you're aware, that your behind is hitting somebody's head, doesn't matter. I must prostrate. This is my space. It's the most sacred moment that I'm going to connect with at this life. Humility to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, to the teacher. Get out of my way. So, you see, you have to watch yourself. What's Dharma here? What's practice here? Prostrations are important, and who would emphasize that more than Tibetan Buddhists? But at the cost of the respect of the others, at the cost of the happiness of the others, not that way. Watching your mind must encompass all subtle and gross habits that are there if one's interest and motivation is to truly transforming one's mind and bringing a change from engaging and being seduced, overpowered by negative emotions, to dawning, giving birth, and strengthening basic awareness, basic sanity. So watch carefully the first affliction. Second is quinzen, grudge, holding grudge. So sometimes we think, oh, grudge? No, not really, not much at all. But you have to watch very carefully your mannerisms and how you relate to somebody else. For example, when you are walking into a room, do you make friends with the environment? If you are not making friends with the environment that you step into, you're holding a grudge, a subtle grudge, that is highlighted because of your past experiences of having extended your warmth to to the others, and perhaps the reciprocation of that warmth was not responded the way you expected it to be so. So we build up. Of course, there are gross grudge of aggression and anger. That is true. But here what I want to point out is the basic feeling that we don't have certain problems, that we may have them occasionally. I may have an occasional grudge, but that grudge is not a very big problem with me. If that kind of a supposition is there within one's own self, then it's a very wrong understanding of one's own nature, one's own personality. Grudge is very, very subtle in our own selves. That's why we hesitate in relating to others. Kindness, readily expressed without expectation, is impeded because of the presence of a subtle grudge in our own minds. He did that, she said that, they did this way to me. Because of this, I am going to do it in this way. My experience of that was that, and therefore I'm not going to approach any moment with a fresh outlook, but I'm going to drag in all my past experiences into every fresh moment that I encounter and meet with them with tainted glasses, rather than seeing and giving it some kind of freedom to be a fresh beginning. When that sort of a tendency arises in one's own self, you are carrying tremendous grudge of your past experiences. And because of that, there is no potential that we have of meeting each moment with a fresh attitude, with a fresh approach. When you see the person, do you give the person to be, you know, the freedom for this person to be an entirely new person, having no predetermined, preformed ideas of your own expectations, of your own attitudes? When that is not there, then grudge is of course there. When grudge is there, in this kind of a tainted attitude and expectation with which we enter environment or relate to the others or even generate a simple thought, then that will impede your mind's ability to give it the freedom that it really deserves. Mind is immediately contained and boxed in the periphery designed by your own expectations and experiences. So the freedom of complete expansiveness, pervasiveness is not there. And so you then after, when you have a grudge and then you cannot approach things in a very fresh way, yes, of course, then you will have to learn how to release that rigid framing or boxing of your own mental attitudes by doing a lot of practices like breathing right, visualizing correctly, thinking about everyone as your mother, seeing someone in front of yourself, visualizing deities upon your head, churning amrita and purifying yourself and light radiating, dissolution and creations. Then sort of all the Lojong practices and the 37 practices and walking the five paths and then obtaining the 10 bhumis and then shunyata and prajnaparamita and rajgira and arahats and bodhisattvas and the whole history of mahasiddhas. You'll have to get into that whole long complex path simply because of one grudge. How sad is that? Choice is up to you. You know, how complicated you want to make it. So look at it. Grudge, is it there? How is it? Recognizing it. Remember, simply seeing these negative, disturbing emotions by name and recognizing them doesn't serve the purpose. Not only should one see what it is, educate your own mind's awareness in being observant and aware of what it is, what tendencies are there to watch out for, but also in your day-to-day practice, exercise greater observance, and watchfulness in seeing shades of these afflictions seeping into your characteristic, into your personality. Likewise, then, the third affliction is then said to be sort of gapa, or to conceal, what is in English called to conceal. Concealment refers to hiding one's own faults to one's own self. Of course, concealing faults to the others But here, and from a much more subtler perspective, concealment of faults to one's own self, which is usually dominant by immediately finding a quick reason why you must be angry. Quick reason and excuses why this selfishness was needed. Quick reason why the arrogance was needed. I'm going to be proud because they're never going to otherwise come around to being humble. Therefore, I have to be proud so that they can practice humility. Now, as far as statements go, this also sounds very nice. Almost a kind thing to do, isn't it? I am being angry so that all of you begin to behave. Now, is it really true? Is it really true, truly compassionate? Of course, we say, yes, one time Buddha was born as this great captain of the ship that killed 500, that man who was going to kill the 500 merchants. So that validates my anger today. That's good. As far as anecdotes go, yes, there is there. We talk about also greater compassion that is not so much apparent, but at the core is very compassionate. That's all very nice. Am I Buddha? I am not Buddha. Where I don't have the capacity to see that a person can kill 500 people, then I don't have the capacity to kill the person, don't have the right to kill that one person who I am only suspicious about. And the suspicion that you are angry is because you are not behaving the way I want you to behave. So you see how the mind begins to work. What do we call another person's arrogance? What do we call another person's aggression? What do we call another person's pride? What do we call the other person's fault? Is basically, you're not living up to my expectations. You live up to my expectations, you become the object of my patience. You do not live up to the expectations that I project to you, then I think you all need to be corrected. And for that, I'm going to be proud, I'm going to be, stern, I'm going to be angry at you. Those are where you are looking at things that are apparent and satisfies the senses, but is not going deeper enough to really examine your own tendencies, your own easy ways, or what are called convenience that you get sort of stuck with, rather than really wishing to transform and working with one's own self. Therefore, in one's own habits, in one's own tendencies, especially when you see negative emotions being generated, try to generate greater awareness that does not immediately support that with a reasoning that comes out, such as, well, you behave badly in sanghas, because I live with a lot of Buddhist community members. In sanghas, sometimes one finds one member behave really badly with another. It may be simple things such as your medication. It may be you're not getting enough meat, it seems to be. Most of the Buddhist centers are vegetarian. And then because of that, daily dose of meat not being there, then you have a bad mood. Or maybe you get a call from somewhere else, or things are not going well, or the plumbing in your room is not working. Whatever it is, it triggers. But the trigger goes out into expressing a lot of discursiveness in the others. But then, as a practitioner, you do realize immediately how badly you are behaving. And you know the back of your mind, oh, it's the plumbing. But you're not going to say, it's the plumbing because of which I'm becoming neurotic here. What you're going to say is, you are not right. You are wrong. The way you are sitting in the shrine room is wrong. The way you spoke with Rinpoche is wrong. The way you made that decision is very wrong. Now, however, at the back of your mind, you immediately have a sense of saying, well, that's not entirely true. I really don't want to behave it in this way. But then you begin to find the most sort of sensible reasoning and the excuses. End of the story of this kind is usually you go back to apologizing, because eventually you are a practitioner and you do realize that that was not good. So you say, I am sorry, but always at that time, look at the reasoning that you give. And if that reasoning is not honest, at least to yourself, but then you come up with all kinds of, you know, skillful ways of concealing your negative habits, what has happened is the root cause of a self-cherishing mind that is predominant in our characteristic has never been addressed. So you are going to now solve the problems more on the symptoms, but not on the root cause. So that is like curing cancer with ibuprofen. Somewhat you can find relief or take any kind of painkiller. Or what we say, trying to recover from a gangrene with a butterfly bandage. Some seconds that you apply, it may cover for some moment. But the rottenness of the self-cherishing attitude, the root cause from where negative emotions arise, doesn't get eliminated. Fourth is then, tsikpa, as we say, what you call anger. I don't know whether the English word anger conveys the same message as the Tibetan word tsikpa or krodh in Sanskrit. Now, tsikpa means to burn. Such an attitude that burns every bit of awareness. So powerful in your mind that when it arises, you cannot see anything. You do not see any positivity. You do not see anything good. You are unable to see anything but a stubborn attitude that craves for something which even you are unable to identify what it is. But you insist that it be done. And so, looking at one's own self and seeing if that kind of abject anger is there within one's own self. An anger so strong that at that moment where it is projected, almost become a different person who's never heard a word of Dharma, who's never heard a word of teachings. And so, in your own observation, in your own watchfulness of your daily attitude, look carefully and see whether you succumb to that kind of a habit, where you forget years and years of training, years and years of practices. And sometimes it is there when we become angry, when we see anger being demonstrated. The third person, and particularly as a third person, it's very easy to see how we forget everything. All the teachings, all the practices, all that what we have learned. Sometimes we may have written books on it, and yet there's no indication of ever having recollected that in one's own mind stream. So that negative affliction has to be eliminated. Tado is the next affliction, jealousy, as it is called. Tado, the literal terminology of the word itself, is unable to see goodness and positivity at all. And so, of course, when we talk about jealousy, then often the thought comes is, yes, jealousy is not really my problem. I get along. As a Buddhist, I try to see the well-being and the progress of every other sentient being. We do have some kind of an assumption of such kind. But I've always felt that jealousy is one of the most powerful afflictions that we suffer from. But because we look at it only from a very gross perspective, we don't really see the subtle presence of that competitiveness which is in our own mind. And so tado, as the word says, is if you want to see whether jealousy afflicts one's mind stream or not, then is to see how do you approach others? How do you approach other people? How do you approach other situations or environments? And how much in your day-to-day ability do you see good things in the others? Are you able to look at a person and see immediately the best feature in that person? Or do you see the best blemish in that person? Do you walk into a room and see the best of that environment? Or do you walk into a room and see the biggest flaw in that environment? Are you able to walk into a party and immediately generate a wish of great happiness and goodness in the achievements of the evening or the day? Or do you walk into it and immediately think how crowded it is, how noisy it is, how you shouldn't have come, What are you doing there? So it's the attitude that is able to see positivity and lack in the ability to see the positivity. If we go by how our habits are, we will find that we are very agreeable to seeing positivities in a very limited way. We see a lot of positivities in what we do. We see a lot of positivities in what our loved ones do. But the ability to see it in the same way of others whom you do not like or do not care about is very difficult. And that mind becomes a cynical mind, a critical mind. Cynicism and criticism as harbored and strengthened within our own selves defeats compassion, defeats genuine kindness. Then you will have to resort to long exercises of how to practice Tonglen, Lojong, read books like Shantideva's Mahayana exposition of six paramitas in the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara. And then all of, again, the complexities of everything begins. And such a person then again has to begin to sort of learn from A, B, C, D, how to practice kindness and compassion. Kindness and compassion is relieving, giving freedom to the others to be as they are, freed from your opinions and judgments, and allowed to be as they are. And in that allowance, not being indifferent to them, not being so inconsiderate of them, but allowing goodness to permeate within one's own mind stream. So as a meditator, anyone who raises one's hand and claims to be a practitioner, looking inward and seeing, do you every day exert effort in thinking positively of the others? Other schools of Buddhism, other practices that others are doing. And here, New York, upstate New York, where yesterday, as I said, so many wonderful Dharma centers, thinking good of everyone, being able to think of all people in this room and thinking well of the other person, and making sure that in your thinking well of the other person, that there is sincerity and honesty. And being able to, in your own mind, see two resistances. One is not to think about them, not to think good about them. Two is fabricating your thinking good about them. That teaches you even more of the sort of how much cultivating of the actual Dharma is happening within one's own mind stream. If that is not there, if the quality of real appreciation, genuine love, genuine tolerance, genuinely thinking good of the others are not there, then in your meditation, the day you say, by this merit may all beings obtain omniscience, freedom from suffering of birth, old age, sickness, and death, always ask yourself, what do you mean by that? Whom do you mean when you say all sentient beings? Did you exclude a few or not? And so, in that way, working with one's own self, likewise, the sixth affliction is stinginess. That's avarice, as you call them in English, or just stinginess. Stinginess of the mind that supposes, on the one hand, it's going to liberate all sentient beings. And simultaneously, so stingy that it is unable to even say a kind word to somebody else. Stinginess is the biggest affliction that we suffer from. A whole lifetime directed only to the sustenance of the self and what it can do for one's own self. But when it comes to engaging in an activity that encompasses others, how much do you do? So I always say, start with clothings. How many clothings did you buy for yourself in this life? How many clothings did you buy for the others? How much food did you put in your own mouth? How much food did you put in the mouths of the others? How much praises have you given to self and your loved ones? How much praises and kind words have you given to those who are around you, who are not necessarily you and yours, but are they still there? How much action have you done in your life for yourself? And how much action each day do you do for somebody else? How much do you think about yourself? And how much do you think about the others? When you examine your own mind, you will find whether or not the affliction of stinginess is what one is suffering from or not. Same mind, however, every day sits in meditation thinking you're going to liberate all sentient beings. A very tall order. Very, very high aspiration. Good to keep, but when will you make it real? To be able to benefit other sentient beings will require you to not be so stingy and self-cherishing all the time, to be so self-absorbed all the time. More than any kind of form, technical or mechanical practices that one may engage in, making a heart that is genuinely kind and wishing goodness, thinking of the well-being of the others is very good. Making sure that even that act of generosity that we sometimes engage in, and sometimes we do things like, oh, I like to cook for others, so therefore I'm going to cook for the others. In all its apparent form, it is a very generous action to do. But again, carefully examining and seeing how much stinginess is there even in that act of generosity is because that act, again, feeds into your own sense of well-being, and therefore, even in your giving, you may be becoming very stingy within your own self. Transformation from a deluded mind to a Buddha mind will require that there be no residue, even the minutest of the residue of fabrication, of distortions, of residues of the ego's agendas. And therefore, where in the Buddha nature, where in the realization of the Buddha mind, there cannot be any stains, there cannot be any delusion, there cannot be any falsities or taintedness, contamination, then it becomes important that in order to realize that, genuine transcendence, genuine purification from such negativities as stinginess also happens. Making sure seventh affliction is also removed. And the seventh affliction is usually called yoa, or I think in English you call them being, most translators use the term dishonest. But again, while it is being dishonest, yoa is to find excuses all the time. Excuses why you can't be good. Excuses why you can't start today. Even in your mind, yes, we should be free from stinginess. Yes, but there's this big English word called but. So B-U-T, and so but. Yes. Yeah, I shouldn't be angry, but. Yes, jealousy is a very good thing. Yes, Rinpoche is correct. Yes, of course, that's how foolish we are. But, you know. So, this is what is yoa. Is you go in the right direction and you take a detour. You are moving ahead and you have a setback. And so in that way, you consistently keep a neurotic tendency in one's own mind, an affliction in your own mind that finds deceptions. And therefore it is called dishonest or even called deceiving others. You deceive others, yes, of course. But remember, in the deceptions, falling prey to the deceptions, while you do bring about a lot of harm to the others, it is nothing in comparison to the harm that you bring to your own self. In the West, many people say things like, how can I be kind to myself? That compassion to the others is good, but compassion to one's own self is also very important. How can we do that? There is no greater kindness or compassion that you can give to your own self than to remove ignorance from one's own mind stream. To consistently harbor misconceptions and deceptions and delusions that are going to constantly create a ripple that makes the energy of pain, confusion, suffering and insanity within one's own self is the biggest damage, harm that we do inflict upon one another. And therefore, here deceiving others is negative, but deceiving one's own self, deceiving one's own self by constantly not approaching Dharma directly and honestly, but trying to constantly bring the profundity of the Dharma into becoming tainted the way we want it to be. And so that is where the biggest problem that we have as Dharma practitioners is that we have to move from ordinary to purity. But instead of doing that, we often bring the purity to sort of fit in into our own deceptions, into our own very relative conceptual mind. And so instead of rising above, we bring what is above to our own level, and then we try to make a mishmash of that. And so that is then deceiving deceptions that we bring that prolongs the sense of generation and realization of one's own intrinsic nature. And that is then completely going in the opposite direction of recognizing preciousness of human existence and the profundity of Dharma. Just as the seventh affliction is the yoa, likewise the eighth is quite similar to that, and that is called ju. Both of them are usually in the Tibetan language referred to as yoju, so almost seen in the same way. So ju is hypocrisy. Just as you evade the issue of genuinely working with your own mind, you develop greater genius ideas as to how to support and sustain the excuses of not working with your own mind. And that's hypocrisy. And so hypocrisy is our disease as practitioners. Each day that you hear one more teaching, each day that we sit in meditation one more time, each day that we recite our supplications and aspirations, each day, however, we go to bed without having done anything more than admiring the theory of this profound view realized once upon a time by somebody else, we are sustaining the hypocrisy within our own selves. And so, likewise, in the day-to-day activity, we always do that. Whenever we support a negative action that we have done with reasoning, that is then behaving hypocritically, succumbing to hypocrisy. And so the purity of the mind needs to have the courage to remove all stains of ju or hypocrisy. Tenth affliction is then said to be japa, as we say. Japa, literally translated, is to become fat. Beautifully, poetically, it is translated as to be intoxicated. Now, whether to become fat or whether to become intoxicated, both of them are true, to become fat with yourself. So the Tibetan term japa is to just become a lump of self-absorption, to become fat with self-absorption. Physical fatness, we're not talking about that. Mind becomes just very healthy, very fat with self-absorption, to be intoxicated with self-absorption, so that you begin to almost have such a pride of your own self that you think, oh, the whole universe moves just for me. And how dare they not therefore behave the way you want it to be. And so every time there is the self-cherishing attitude, self-absorption, that so dominates that it is unable to see anything. For example, pride of the self. The self-absorption can be as big as this room. If I have this kind of a affliction of myself, then I will become, my self-absorption will become so big that it won't see this room at all. It will disregard and it will feel suffocated being sort of so big that this room is itself too small for it. And that is where you begin to have more animosity towards the others. Wherever the growth, however the big the self-absorption, it will always have more demands. And the nature of the world, of samsara, is that all demands are not met. Things won't go your way. Wherever there is greater demand, there is greater not being met with the expectations, and that inflicts tremendous animosity within one's own self. Therefore, one becomes what we call, sadly, obnoxious Buddhists, who almost have so much aggression in one's own self. And that is all done in the, it's a very strange sort of a dilemma with which we live. Is on the one hand, you are a very good person because of the power of the teachings and the aspiration to truly bringing about freedom from all beings, for all beings, is very strong within one's own self. But at the same time, because of this self absorption that is very strong in one's own self, one doesn't even realize how rude one's behavior is, how abrasive one's attitude is. And in that rudeness and abrasiveness, there is so much. Yesterday we talked about this sense of defensiveness, that you have to defend yourself all the time. You develop offensiveness. And in that aggression, as it manifests, you do become someone that people don't really like meeting. And so sometimes I always think you have to be very careful that if you see who you are becoming to such a point where people are making great efforts to going another path because you're walking in their direction, realize there's something wrong with you. It's not always the mistake of the other person who doesn't see the goodness in you. There may be some truth in also seeing, why is it that people don't like talking to you? Why is it that you don't have much friends? Why is it that you have become so very distant from everybody else? If there is disintegration of pride, of ego, one should be able to mingle and be friendly and have friends and be able to meet another person in much more peaceful ways. Wherever that is not being done, then you will find yourself cut off from the others. And then you'll become a very sad thing, a lonely, sad person who's going to liberate all sentient beings. So it's a paradox, looking into one's own self and seeing whether that is there or not is very important. Furthermore, Mohatameba is the Nambartsava is the 10th negativity. And Nambartsava is harming others. Non-hesitation in inflicting harm upon the others. So if this kind of a careless attitude is there within one's own self, then again one has to be very careful. Simply wishing for disturbing emotions to go so that one is happy all the time, one is peaceful all the time, one is able to have a much more sense of equanimity and awareness without the disturbing emotions arising. You know, this is what we hope. Whenever we try to say, how can I overcome disturbing emotions? Primarily what we're looking for is a meditation session. Maybe not the life, we don't have such high expectations, but we think at least the shamatha that I'm doing, shine that I'm doing, should be free from the thoughts. I'm labeling thoughts, I'm dropping them, I'm trying to practice single-pointed concentration, I'm breathing correctly, I'm reciting correctly, I'm resting the mind without grasping, I'm looking at the empty nature of mind and phenomena. We are trying to do this, and then therefore, how can I still not be inflicted with so many neurotic thoughts? How can I overcome disturbing emotions? This is something that we always are trying to find out. But these are branches. These are blossomings of leaves and buds, all symptomatic conditions that are happening. And what we are trying to say is, you can never aspire for leaves and buds to not fruition if the root, the trunk of the tree, is very strong. Trunk of the tree, root of the tree, all of these things are the branches. The trunk of the tree is the self-cherishing attitude. The self must be trained. And therefore, that training of the self requires the mind to be free from agitation and anxiousness. An agitation and an anxiousness so produced and so ceaselessly produced in such a continuum that it becomes fear. Where the anxiousness and the agitation becomes fear, it doesn't hesitate to harm another sentient being. And physically, verbally, through the projection of many different thoughts, being someone who inflicts the harm comes very easily within our own selves. So in order to be free from a negative emotion that thinks negatively of harming another, one must first reduce fear. In order to reduce fear, one must let go of the sense of agitation and apprehension. Sense of agitation and apprehension arises because there seems to be a strong self-cherishing attitude. Therefore, look at the self. Look at the nature of the self. See how much of that self-cherishing attitude is a simple thought that supposes nothing but it supposes. Is a supposition to be so strong? Where is the sanity in simply living by a supposition? Does that supposition not require further investigation? And all our teachings, and many of you are familiar with the Buddha's words, in examining that assumption, in examining that supposition, we do find that thoughts are essentially, as we fabricate them to be, empty in nature. So out of that, what doesn't exist, should one succumb to such an anxiousness that is unable to relieve oneself from the fear that comes out and is expressed as anger and intention and actions of harming others, thinking in that way, one must free oneself from the attitude and the affliction, negative emotion of intentions of harming others, or the intention of not hesitating to harming others. In the same way, one must always cultivate mota, as we say in Tibetan. In English, something that is sometimes, because you all have received many teachings, perhaps this is already something that you are aware of and is not a problem to you. But often for people who are not very familiar with Buddhist terminology, to have shame almost is a derogatory sort of a term in English, in the Western languages, to have shame. So people almost sort of say, what does that really mean, to have shame? Now, to have shame is not to be shy or to always have shame about oneself, almost the same meaning as to have guilt about one's own shortcomings. Here, mota mepa is where you are not embarrassed by one's own negative actions. Because where there is no embarrassment, where there is no sense of hesitation with what you are inflicting, a harm that you are inflicting on the others, it immediately destroys the one very good quality called awareness. Awareness, as it arises, becomes diminished or subjugated by a sense of not being aware or embarrassed by the negative actions. So if one is embarrassed by the negative actions and the negative habits, sort of seeing, oh my, all of these years of practicing the Dhamma, and when you watch your mind, you see so much arrogance, being embarrassed with your own arrogance. When you look at your own self and see how much laziness is there, or how much selfishness is there, or how much more you give in to your own desires, rather than being able to have tolerance and kindness and patience, where emotions that are very neurotic dominate the mind, and you are able to see that and say, after all these years of Dharma, after all these years of practice, after the devotion that I have for the Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha, still, how strong are these afflictions? And becoming embarrassed with one's own inability to developing greater sense of insight, greater sense of awareness, that is a very essential quality for all meditators. Because when that is not done, all the previous negativities or discursivenesses will continue to retain their power over basic awareness. And so, looking at one's own negative actions and being ashamed by them, but simply being ashamed by them leads to guilt. Not doing that, but that the sort of referring to them, being embarrassed, leading to a stronger determination to break free from repetitiveness of such behavior. Where the repetitiveness of one's, the impulses of these discursivenesses is cut through, then one is truly engaging on the path of the teachings correctly. Therefore, it is very important that the sort of shame or the embarrassment bring about the determination to cut habitual impulses. In the same way, te meba, as we say, mota da te yu, te meba is dread of blame, as it is often translated by translators. And that is where one is not concerned about the retaining of negative actions. So dread of blame is not about being afraid that somebody else is going to blame you. That's not what is meant by te yu here. Teyu simply means somebody who doesn't care what others think about you at all. And so it's very, very interesting, especially in a society sometimes where the common norm of lifestyle is you do whatever comes in your mind. And so people say things like, I've noticed often in the West, which I find very, very interesting, is where parents teach children, Buddhist parents especially, I think have sometimes not the best way of bringing up children. You say things like, would you like to close the door? You know, obviously, the door needs to be closed. Parents don't say, no, close the door. They say, would you like to close the door? And then I remember the child saying, no. And so, in a way, one can understand that is teaching children to really think about what one should be doing. There's a very good approach to that. But on the other hand, it does also speak a lot about a whole culture where your feelings are very important, your emotions are very important, how you express yourself is also very important. Now, I always give the example of this one nun that we had in our nunnery. She came to become a nun. Yeah, of course, it's not easy. And she had the habit of saying the most cutting things about the other person. Never would a day go by when she didn't think of something bad to say to a person who was most conscious of that negative attitude. So one day, of course, then all the nuns, they try to be very understanding and let that be, because this is a new person. So 1 week passes, second week passes. After a while, nobody can tolerate anymore. So, you know, if a person is, let's say, has a crooked nose, there's no reason to go up to that person saying, you have a crooked nose. If a person has some other kind of a habit or a kind of a thing, there's no reason to go and say that. But she would make it a point. So then they came up to me, and then I called her into my room. And I said to her, why do you do this? And she said, oh, because I like it. That's a way I train myself. Because every night I sit and I think of all the bad things that I see, and then it becomes my problem and I can't sleep well. So the next morning, the first thing she does is to say it out so that it no longer is her problem anymore. It's the problem of the person she's given that remark to. So I told her, do you realize that it's no longer your problem, but then it becomes the problem of the other person? And she says, I don't care. As long as it's not my problem, it doesn't matter. So sometimes that kind of a metaphor has to be kept in one's own mind. Many of us do that. In our pursuit to keeping sane mind, keeping mind peaceful, we often don't care. We may not say it out loud, but also there is a reluctance and a carelessness in our attitude and conduct that is unfeeling, indifferent, and inconsiderate of the needs and the well-beings of the others. In your mind, you have to watch. If one truly wishes to work with one's own self, you have to look at that in one's own self and say, in my own behavior, in my own attitude and conduct, am I also somebody who is relating to situations in such a way that it is totally inconsiderate of the well-beings of the others, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if they call me angry. It doesn't matter if they call me selfish. I don't care. I must get my space. I must get my way to practicing the meditation and the practices. There was one time in the middle, in the monastery, one person came to practice meditation. And he loved shamatha. Always said he loved shamatha. Westerner. Now, monks have a day off on Tuesday where the younger monks are allowed to play soccer. So also what happens is on a day off, a lot of visitors come to the monasteries. So this person who liked to meditate obviously didn't find good place to meditate in the shrine room. So got very upset and went and sat in the middle of the field to meditate. Then the monks come out to play soccer. So then I happen to be going around the circumambulation of the monastery, and what I see is monks playing soccer, and this man meditating in the middle of the field. And my first reaction, the soccer ball is going to hit the meditator. Mm-hmm. And the second was, why is he meditating in the middle of the field where all monks are running around with the soccer? Mm-hmm. So then, you know, it's a way of looking at it. And I sat there for some time hoping at least sometimes that the monks would stop playing, or at least that this monk, whoever, had a better awareness. Either the monk stopped playing soccer because there was a meditator, or the meditator stopped meditating and let the little boys play that soccer for a little while and meditated in his or her own room. But it doesn't happen. Sometimes we are so absorbed in our own path of liberation and in this big project of trying to find cessation from samsara. We don't allow simple common sense and logic to arise in the mind. And that is probably one of the reasons why there is a majority of the population in the world today that is very skeptical about religion and spiritual practice. Because when you become spiritual and religious, very oftentimes, I joke with the nuns and the monks, and I always say, what happens? When we shave our hair, do we also shave basic common sense together with it? So that's something to think, now, with or without hair. But oftentimes, here we are talking about an unconcerned behavior that does not respond to the needs of the others and places that as more important than everything else, including your devotion and commitment to the path of the practices. You can go for a day without meditating if that has been a cause and a basis of happiness and convenience, well-being for the others. That is how one must train one's own mind. 13th affliction is said mukpa, dullness. Just dullness of the mind that doesn't awaken itself to the potentials that one has. Best is if you are aware of your Buddha nature, primordially enlightened mind. Second best is if you can awaken yourself to the capacity of genuine compassion. And the minimum is that you have common sense, that you have a discerning mind, mindfulness that can discern between what to abandon, what to cultivate. If these three things still are things that a meditator is not aware of, then it is succumbing to the affliction of mental dullness that is sort of very blunt. And since the bluntness doesn't have the penetrating wisdom, it will not bring about much transformation in one's attitude and conduct. 14th is addiction. Gopa is often the term in Tibetan, and it is translated many times as excitement and distraction caused by the excitement. But on the other hand, for meditators, I think gopa is something to really watch out, because it is addiction to excitement. And then if you notice in your own self, you find one thing that you talk about always. How can I find the inspiration to practice? Now, what do you mean by inspiration to practice? You're going to one day die, and you're creating tremendous karma. There cannot be anything more exciting or inspiring than that to get you to becoming able to work on the path of transformation. But that is not sufficient. The dullness of the mind immediately gives you a sense that that is not sufficient inspiration. And you begin to allow yourself to believing inspiration must depend on other things. And therefore, that is what happens. It's like the modern day fashion styles that are there. And you have to find always a constant inspiration to bringing out a new thing. And it's amazing to see what you can do with, let's say, one garment, such as a skirt. And through hundreds of years, what a human mind has been doing in terms of each day, each year, finding a different skirt. Black, same black color, but amazingly how you can still find something that is new that you don't have that you can buy. New York is a good place. If you drive and you see all those shops that displays those clothings on the mannequins and so forth, I'm always amazed at the geniusness of a human mind that can actually come up with some lopsided clothings here, sometimes it is this way, sometimes they all look torn, sometimes they all look like stitched up, sometimes it's plain, sometimes it's different. But, you know, it has to be an absolute genius of a mind that can actually create something new all the time and tempt others enough to then be able to say, that is what I don't have, and therefore I must get more. So in the same way, the mind does come up with all of these many different kinds of deceptions, where we are talking as a metaphor leading that to our own mind, is where the mind is unable to find true inspiration in the truth as it is that stares right into ourselves, but find much more the dependence upon other things. So therefore, new teachers become exciting, new practices become exciting, male and female teachers become exciting. I always am very much amused when people say, oh, the female Rinpoche who is here, sort of, is that supposed to make any difference? Yeah. And so, maybe, but it is short-lived, remember that. You know that receiving the same teachings from a female teacher whom you have not heard from before, that excitement is probably maximum 15 minutes. Or when a session ends and you can convey that excitement to the other person, that's when it immediately dies. If the dependency upon external, now remember, teachers are very important, teachings are very important, where you karmically connect, those are all very important. But when you take only the external appearance, the charisma, as the factor that generates the excitement, then just as fashion designers have to each year come up with a catwalk, an exciting design fresh of this new year, you might have to have a catwalk for the teachers to come up with exciting methods each year that will pep up your in sort of mind to be more motivated in changing your own attitude, bringing about the transformation. Becoming free from such addictions to external factors that inspire your mind is very important. Because where that is not done, where that is an addiction that becomes very strong, you are sustaining a dullness of your own wisdom mind, which is unable to see clearly the truth of impermanence and karma. Placing one's inspiration in the fact that stares really into our own mind, that is change, transformation, impermanence, karma, in the meanwhile, the karma that you create and causes that affect your life and the lives of the others. That should be the true inspiration that wakes you up from the state of dullness that refuses to change, bring about the transformation from abandoning negative causes and conditions, negative afflictions, and generating awareness and watchfulness. 14th then is the excitement is what we're talking about. And so the sense of excitement that it is addicted to. In the same way, madepa, not trusting, or the 15th, the affliction that we are talking about is not having devotion, as it is called. Madepa, not having faith, not having trust, not having devotion to karma. Not to teachers, teachings, practices, but not trusting the truth of cause and condition. To be able to really bring about change and transformation of one's own attitude and conduct, really seeing the power and the truth of karma becomes very important. Yesterday evening I had said I would mention this. And so cause and effect, karma, must be seen as the continuum of sort of impulses or the sense of constantly being propelled into a habitual action without the force of which being so strong that it almost completely subjugates basic awareness and mindfulness. Being so driven, propelled so very strong, forced so much into an action or any kind of a thought or any kind of a verbal speech where you do not have the potential to rest a bit and discern between what to cultivate, what to abandon. Such kind of a state of non-freedom is then said to be being propelled by karma. So when we are propelled, when we are pushed, when we are forced by the force of karma, the wind of karma, then the actions are repeatedly, ceaselessly created. Such actions then become further seeds and causes that determine the existence as well as the experiences within the existence for self and the others. As a meditator, to have enough time, give yourself enough opportunity to see yourself engaging in the creation of karma consistently, ceaselessly, is very important. As the teachers have said, even the blinking of your eyes have the power of creating an environment for self and others, an experience for self and the others, which is usually in respect talking about the power of immediacy of many ceaseless moments of causes and conditions that one is creating. Where that is not understood, we think karma is all the gross, bigger thoughts and actions that we create. Yes, those are karma. Those are very gross and easy to identify. But subtle karma, the mental continuum that you create, and each of the mental thoughts that you have, whether you are aware of it or not, whether others are aware of it or not, still, each single one of them have the power of becoming a cause. A cause that will immediately become an experience of self or the others. A cause that will again become a residue that settles to determining what kind of a personality you will build up. That personality which will relate to the external world and determine your life. That karma that will be projected immediately, that has an effect that instigates further productions of other karma, and the manifold ways in which the causes are created must be observed, such that the meditator begins to really have a sense of how, almost what we call let loose you are into this world. And so if a mad elephant is let loose into an arena of people and the kind of havocs that it can create, likewise, if you look at you and your karma that is being rapidly produced, consistently being produced, you will find yourself not very different from a mad elephant that has been let loose in society. And so where that is then there, then of course, what we are, who we are, what we experience, what our life has become, what we are creating our life to becoming, is all dependent upon karma. And one's own karma is within one's own reach. That understanding of karma, oh yes, it is powerful. Therefore, it is important that I correct my own attitude and conduct. That understanding is then the potent recollection or the potent sort of factor that will allow you to see wisdom in why the transformation of the disturbing emotions is needed. Why it is important to eliminate negativities, these afflictions that we are talking about, and why transforming them into a positive attitude becomes essential, because where negativities are being retained, the force of the impulse of the karma creates a momentum of many causes that then become the field of our experience, which we call the world. So the world we create is dependent upon the causes that we create. The causes that we create are being rampantly, ceaselessly being generated from within one's own self. When one looks at it in that way, then one finds, who else should it be but one's own self that begins on the path of transformation of negative attitude and conduct to positive attitude and conduct. Therefore, trust is very important. Where that trust in the cause and effect is not there, we dismantle. And whatever we dismantle the good qualities, whatever goodness that we are trying to build up, will find no reason or no purpose to actualizing the path of transformation, for which the 16th affliction must be eliminated, and that is laziness. So nothing is easy. How can I easily become enlightenment? I'm sure nobody thinks that way. But on the other hand, there is hope that there is an exception in one's own case, that we can lazily, however, also obtain enlightenment. Practice is difficult, of course. Everything is difficult. Putting food on your plate itself is so difficult, who else would know it better than you all? Here we are talking about lifetimes and lifetimes of habitual patterns needing to be eliminated from a mind that is so used to it, so familiar with it, that although we may not like it, but it is still one of those best friends that we have, that we know we can turn back to. And therefore, the comfort of being able to return back to rude behavior, the comfort of knowing how you will feel when you are angry, not liking it, but it's so familiar. And therefore, the comfortableness and the familiarity will always make it very difficult for us to exert genuine effort and to defeat this tendency of laziness. Therefore, if in one's own mind ever there is a thought, this is going to be easy, then there is no good news at all here at all. It is going to be difficult, and because of which you are known as the bodhisattvas and the future Buddhas. It is difficult, but still, what is not difficult in this world? Isn't it? And so where there are everything that is difficult, why not at least exert effort in that difficult thing that produces the greatest benefit for self and the others? Therefore, defeating, eliminating laziness is important. Likewise, eliminating the 17th affliction, bhavmeva, carelessness, is also very important. Being able to develop strengthened mindfulness and awareness that is able to subjugate a careless attitude. So carelessness, wherever there is, then engaging in the path of transformation is very difficult. Compassion, if you are fond of the subject and wish to generate compassion, you cannot be careless. If you want to practice genuinely resting your mind in its absolute true nature, you cannot be careless. If you are devoted to the teachings and the teacher, you cannot be careless. And therefore, being able to really generate strengthened mindfulness and awareness, eliminating carelessness, is important. Likewise, just as eliminating carelessness is important, then 18th affliction, forgetfulness, jñāna, as it is called, is very important. Teachings once one receives, any teachings, must be carved in your own mind. So, you know, taping it is very good, writing is it very good, you know, all kinds of efforts that we do to try to recollect and remember the teachings, those are all very good. But utilizing them to maintain more reminding of the teachings becomes essential, and especially not forgetting them when you most need them. One must not forget patience when you are angry. One must not forget generosity when you're becoming tight in your mind. One must not forget generating awareness and strengthened mindfulness when you're really wanting to be lazy. Therefore, forgetfulness is the pattern that the ego-based mind usually sort of cashes in on in order to make oneself pretend to be someone who hasn't heard a word of any of these teachings. Anything that I've spoken in the last 2.5 hours or so is something you all always knew. So, not pretending this is the first time you've heard it. Furthermore, not pretending when engaged in the actions. Likewise, in order for the forgetfulness, the carelessness, the laziness, the above three mentioned afflictions to becoming strong, one must make sure that the 19th affliction called namying must be abandoned, and that is distraction. Yes, genuine awareness is an intrinsic quality that is within, inherent of our own selves. It cannot be more close than being inherent. But on the other hand, the distraction, the senses' distraction on the outwardness, creates often a sense of not really being able to be in touch with the basic mindfulness and the awareness. Therefore, being humble in knowing that the outer distractions can create a sense of sort of momentums which do not let you become able to work with the positive qualities that need to be strengthened at this time. Therefore, here is where one engages more in being more realistic with one's own practices. Although the basic quality of wisdom is inherent, as I said, nevertheless, since it is still very weak in that the distractions and the attraction to the distractions are so very strong, one must overcome distractions by strengthening diligence in meditation, in giving yourself the opportunity to really engage in samadhi, in shamatha, vipassana meditations, because of which then one is able to uproot the 20th affliction, and that is called shejin mepa, or weakened prajna of discernment. Wherever the mind, the wisdom that is able to discern between what to abandon, what to cultivate, is weak, then everything that we talk about in terms of transforming emotions, negative to positive, is going to be very futile. It's going to be useless. So the prajna of discernment is going to be essential. Where the prajna of discernment is sort of strong, it immediately weakens the distraction. Where the distractions are weak, that allows the strengthening of the inherent wisdom's quality to becoming more strong. So for lunch, I will stop over here. And then from here on, perhaps go into two directions. One, the more Mayana approach of looking at the root cause, a bit of that. And then a practice that I find myself very much benefiting from, and that is usually in the teachings of the Mahasiddhas, of looking at the nature of emotions and self-liberating them. So two topics that I will then relate to in terms of how to engage in the practices of meditation of releasing negative emotions.